If you love the History Extra podcast, make sure you follow us to keep up to date and get all the latest episodes. Thanks for your support, and I do hope you enjoy this episode.
This episode is brought to you by Indeed. We're driven by the search for better, but when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/History Extra. Just go to Indeed.com/History Extra right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
Life is a highway, and on it there will be many chicken sandwiches. But there's only one McCrispy, so go ahead and hit the turn signal if you know about this juicy gem of a detour.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. I bet you get 30, 30, I bet you get 30, I bet you get 20, 20, 20, I bet you get 20, 20, I bet you get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month, sold.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code SPOTIFY for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Hello and welcome to the History Extra podcast from BBC History Magazine, Britain's best-selling history magazine. I'm Ellie Cawthorne. Marie Antoinette is one of the most famous queens of the 18th century, and she often overshadows the other women in her family. But according to the historian Nancy Goldstone, they should perhaps demand just as much attention. In her new book, she explores the life of the Habsburg Empress Maria Theresa, a formidable force on the European stage, alongside her daughters Maria Christina, who became Governor General of the Austrian Netherlands, Maria Carolina, Queen of Naples, and Marie Antoinette herself. Putting the questions to Nancy was our acting digital editor, Eleanor Evans.
You've written that everyone's heard of Marie Antoinette, of course, but her mother is much less well known, and her sisters have actually been quite routinely ignored. But you say that this is a shame because Marie Antoinette was actually the least interesting, and perhaps we can start there.
Well, it's not that she, I mean, her life ends up being very interesting, of course, but yes, I think when I started this book, the reason I wrote about the sisters, her sisters as well as her mother, was because I have been doing this long enough now. I've been coming up through the centuries, and I understand that if you write, that's why when I did Catherine de' Medici and Margaret de Valois, if you can carry through to the next generation, you really understand how everything plays out and why. And so I am embarrassed to admit that I didn't really even think about Marie Antoinette having sisters, because she's such a huge person, it's such a huge personality. She takes all the oxygen out of the room. And but her sisters were actually amazing. I only was there. She had seven. There were seven of them all together. But I focused on the ones who are really in political, who are political powers, because I'm very interested in how women in power worked in these centuries, and that's why I always do queens or empress in this case. And so I was just struck by how the other sisters also had to deal with everything that Marie Antoinette had to deal with, and in one case, more, and how they handled it. So it was, and the mother, of course, Maria Theresa, she had one of the most vivid experiences coming into power that I have ever read about, I've ever learned about. So I loved reading about them.
Absolutely.
And writing about them.
Absolutely, me too. And so if we go to Maria Theresa to start then, this is, as you've mentioned, your sixth book of European history. Could you give us a sense of the Europe that Maria Theresa was born into and her status in that?
Well, what was so interesting about Maria Theresa was that she was a Habsburg, and she's coming into a period where the Habsburgs are, when she's first born, the Habsburgs are still very, very powerful, but they have just come off Louis XIV, the Sun King, has just come in and taken half of their property by taking over Spain and the New World. And so Maria Theresa's father has less property at and has less subjects and less inheritance to give out afterwards than almost any other Habsburg before this, but he still has a huge amount of property. He is Archduke of Austria, he's King of Hungary, he's King of Bohemia, he's got the Austrian Netherlands, which is basically Belgium and Flanders, he's got parts of Italy. This is a large inheritance, but he had also used to have, or the Habsburgs used to have, a member of the family used to have Spain and the New World and Southern Italy, and there was just a lot of territory that the Habsburg no longer commanded. And her father has the additional problem was he can't have a son. He keeps trying and trying and all he's got are these two daughters, which is a catastrophe in their minds, of course. And so he has to leave his property to his daughter. And she's only 23 years old. He's completely untrained for this. She's pregnant with her fourth child when he suddenly dies, and she inherits everything. And immediately, the other major powers, not Britain, but we can get to that, the other major powers all decide to attack her at the same time because, you know, on the grounds that she's a woman and too weak to defend her property, too weak to rule, she shouldn't be ruling. So they all invade her at the same time. And I love her because she just, she whacks them back. She will not give up. And she eventually survives that. And who would not want to write that story, really? That was where we started from. That's where she starts from.
Yes, she's a pretty formidable woman. And if we can pick up on how she reacts to these invasions, or perhaps one antagonist in particular, Frederick the Great, who seems to pop up so much throughout your account, what is the relationship and situation there?
Well, all historians love Frederick the Great because not only is he completely amoral and double dealing and great copy, but he does it all with a sardonic one-liner at the end. So he's just so much fun to read about. But Frederick the Great, it's very sad. Frederick was gay, and his father did not want him to be gay and abused him terribly. I mean, I'm not going to go into the story, but and it turned Frederick from who was actually, you know, a very intelligent guy who loved poetry and music and beautiful things. And it turned him very dark. And he decides when he becomes king, his father, in addition to that, has left him all this money and this huge army, which the father had never used, because Prussia at that time was, you have to think, Prussia was just was not a big player in anything, was just a little regional power. And Frederick decides when Maria Theresa comes to power, he can just go in there and take part of her property, and there'll be no problem at all. And she ends up fighting him. This is a war. What's so interesting about the War of the Austrians in Succession, which starts in 1740s, but goes on for two. There's a brief hiatus after 7 years, and then they start all over again with the Seven Years' War. It's the same basic war, and it's all about whether a woman should be allowed to inherit. I mean, that's it, really. Should a woman be allowed to inherit property? This is the first one I can think of because she's the first one who ever, anybody ever tried to leave their subjects and their realms to. And he just, he is her nemesis. And she comes at it, she just wants to defend herself. She doesn't want other people's property. She wants to defend her property and she wants to be able to have a chance to bring improvements to her subjects. Whereas Frederick is very opportunistic and he just wants to get as much property as he can. He also tries to, you know, he wants a strong state, but he's much more interested in glory and getting a large, getting other people's territory and improving and making Prussia a big power. And so she is ends up being in this arms race with him and having to try to bring him down, try to defend herself and try to actually stop him. She hadn't been there to try and to really stop him. I think Frederick would have just, if it had been her father or somebody, I think he would have just walked over whoever was there. But she really fought him. So Prussia doesn't actually take over until the next century. But, you know, in this time, she stops him, which is fabulous.
Can we talk a little bit more about how she does that then? There's this really very interesting gambit. I'm not sure if that's the right word. She makes in Hungary. Can we say something about
yes,
that?
So Frederick invades. Frederick pretends that he pretends to be her friend when she first inherits the property. Pretends to be her friend, but at the same time, gets his army together. I mean, he got his army. I think she inherited it in November, and within 8 days, he had his plan together. He had his general picked. He had his army coming together, and within 2 weeks after that, he's just marched into Silesia, which was her property, and at the same time. And she gives battle to him there, and he wins that battle, although he was not there because Frederick came with his troops. This was going to be his first big battle, and he's very excited. He starts the charge. The Austrian cavalry, which is very practiced, charges against him and he gets scared and runs away. He gets on his horse and he just leaves his army and flees and ends up in a mill somewhere, you know, miles away. And his general is actually the one who continues the battle and wins the battle. So that they said when Frederick actually, they had to go find Frederick and tell him that he had won the battle. And they said he returned all covered in fame and flour from the mill. But because he won that battle, when you won a battle in the 18th century, all of a sudden you got a lot of allies. So the French decide that it would be a great idea to ally with Frederick because he's already doing such a good job. They can come in and take some stuff. Bavaria decides that they can come in and take some stuff. Saxony comes out, they can come in and take some stuff. So she's got all these, Maria Theresa, all of a sudden she has all these different armies marching on her. And she has no more, her father, of course, who loved her, has no more troops. Left her hardly any troops, left her hugely in debt. She's got almost nothing. So what she does is she goes to, but she is queen of Hungary. She did inherit Hungary. So she goes over to the Hungarians to ask them to help her. Now, Hungary, her advisors, who she inherited from her father, they're like, no, you can't go to Hungary. Because the Hungarians were viewed as being very rebellious. And they just as soon turn on the Austrians as help them. But Maria Theresa, she said, no, I'm their queen. I respect them. She dresses up in Hungarian colors. She brings an entire entourage there. She gets herself crowned queen, which is a great ceremony where She has to put on this really old robe of Saint Stephen, and she goes to the church, and she is, Maria Theresa was very smart, intelligent woman, and she knew a lot of languages, and she knew Latin, and that was the language that in which she communicated with the Hungarians. So she was able to do the whole service in their language. And afterwards, the really key element of the coronation ceremony was that she gets on a horse. She has to get on a horse, still wearing the robe with a big sword, the sword of St. Stephen, and she has to gallop up a hill and wave that sword in four directions in order to show that she will protect Hungarians from enemies from all sides. I mean, it's just such a great picture. She had just given birth to her first child, a son, finally. And so they are the Hungarians. Because she completely captures their hearts. And then she asks them for soldiers. And the way she does it is she brings her it wasn't even 6 months old, her son. And she brings him in front of the Diet, which is their governing body. And she lifts him up in the air and says, "This is my, you know, please help me." And she says it all in Latin, this wonderful speech in Latin. "I will help me now, and I will always defend you. And here is the symbol of our relationship, the child." And the Hungarians just go crazy, and they vote her all these soldiers. And the Hungarian soldiers were tough. They were tough guys. And all of a sudden, the Bavarians and the French say, "Ooh, we have to fight the Hungarians." So it changes the whole war strategy. And that was her first step in fighting back. So she really was. She really did it. It's such a colorful. I hope somebody ends up filming it. I'd love to see it, wouldn't you? To see her, with her, they had her hair blonde, all this hair, blonde hair streaming behind her, and with the sword. I think it's terrific. So
I'd love to see that too. I wonder if any producers are listening. Okay, so if that is a wonderful sort of snippet into her approach to foreign policy and military matters, I wonder if we can look at her a bit in terms of her own rule. There was one aspect that I found fascinating. You write that she appointed an official whose entire job was to critique her behaviour and her own rule. So what does that tell us about her sort of approach to her rule?
Wasn't that wonderful? I thought that was the most impressive thing about her, because you see what we have. Because what she did was she knew that her father had made just a series of terrible decisions, and she had watched him lose one fight after another and get into all kinds of crazy schemes that he should never. And she recognized that it was because his council, just let him do. They just let him do whatever he wanted to, and they just wanted to keep their own positions. They never confronted him. They just encouraged him to do whatever he wanted to do. And she said, "That's just not the way to do it. I need someone to tell me when I'm making a mistake. And I will need someone to show me when my behavior goes wrong." And can you imagine? And no other, first of all, can you imagine anyone doing that with Frederick the Great? No, never would he have somebody. Or even today, would any leader really get somebody in there hopefully they have someone who will tell them the truth. But she actually employed someone. She told him that he did not want that job. There's nobody who wants a job. That's not the way to advancement, to tell your sovereign that they shouldn't speak that way to someone else, or that they've made a mistake. But he took it on, and he made her friend her whole life. It was Count Taruka was his name. And he did it. He told her when she was out of line. He told her when she wasn't making decisions properly, when she was making decisions too passionately. He told her, "Take a breath, stop, think about it, then approach it." I mean, it was just, I thought that was such a wonderful comment on her behavior, on who she was. She really, really wanted to do a great job. Maria Theresa read every paper that passed her desk. She chaired her own council meetings. She made every policy decision. She agonized over it. I mean, the job eventually engulfed her. It was a huge job for her. But I never saw anybody try so hard. And she mostly succeeded. And the reason there was peace for a long time after the end of the Seven Years' War was because of her, or as much as it could be. So I thought she was that I think. Now, she had some things really wrong with her, I will tell you right up. She was horrible about religion, especially not just to the Protestants. She was very Catholic. She was very religious, very pious, and she believed everybody should be Catholic. So she was terrible to Protestants, and she was really terrible to Jews. She wanted to kick all the Jews out. She was horribly anti-Semitic. When they wouldn't let her kick out, when her advisors talked to her calmly, when Taruka and all these people said, no, you need, she made them pay extra fines. You know, no Protestant or no Jew could hold positions in government. Now, it was kind of the reverse of what you had in England at the time, actually, because you had to be Church of England at that time to hold a position in government. But that was a really black mark against her. And she just couldn't get over that. And that was a product of her education, but it didn't matter. She should have been able to. I'm not saying she should have been able to, but that was something that she could not stop. And it was a time when tolerance was just coming into being. It was the Enlightenment. They were just starting. Her son was very tolerant after he took over, but she just couldn't do it. And so you have to, whenever you consider Maria Theresa, no matter how, and I do think she was such a strong and a good leader, this is a huge black mark on her.
Another interesting factor, not a flaw per se, but perhaps linked into that theme of tolerance, her celibacy commission, where did that come from? maybe we can talk about her husband and her relationship.
Right. So Maria Theresa was one of the few princesses who got to marry for love. She married Francis Stephen of Lorraine. He had no real property. In fact, he had to sign away his property. He had to sign away Lorraine in order to marry her, which was something he did not want to do, but was kind of forced on him by her father. And he was actually, she was engaged to him almost from the time she was 6 and he was like 13 or 14. And so she adored him. She just adored him. And for a long time he loved her and he was so supportive during the early years of the marriage. But Maria Theresa ended up having 16 children in 20 years. And that's going to take a toll on, and also she's working all the time. And Francis, her husband, started cheating. And he cheated, pretty regularly. And she couldn't bear it. And first she tries the tears and then and all that with him and tries to make him feel bad. And he would apologize, but he would do it again and again. So what she did was she decided to legislate that all men should have to be should have to be monogamous to their, should never be able to cheat on their, no adultery in Vienna. So she does this kind of chastity commission where she sends out what will eventually evolve into the secret police to go. And if you were a single woman walking in the streets, even if you weren't, a prostitute, they bundled you out of town. She would invade people's parties, their homes while they were having dinner parties to make sure that nobody, there was no fooling around going there. Any soldier that went to a brothel that she caught him, lost his commission. It was just ridiculous. It didn't last for very long. And the funniest thing was that Casanova happened to be in Austria at that time. And boy, did he get out of town fast. That was not his idea of a good time. So, but she only did it for a little while, but this is where she was at. She thought that people should be moral. In that sense, she thought that religion gave her subjects a center, and that people should behave in a certain way with each other. And unfortunately, people don't always behave that way, and that's just what happens, and that's their right. You usually don't want to go in and legislate people's private lives. It doesn't work.
Sure. So you mentioned it in your last answer that she had 16 children. And, you know, even if she stopped sort of legislating in people's private lives, she certainly had license to legislate or certainly direct her children's lives in a certain type of way. What was she like as a mother, and what were her ambitions and her goals for these children?
I have to admit that Maria Theresa was not a great mother, because she played favorites. She really... first of all, her eldest son, because there had been no son in the family for so long, because her father never was able to sire a son. By the time her son with Joseph was her fourth child, so she had already had three girls, and she was just so grateful to have Joseph, who is her eldest son. She, you know, considered him a gift from God, and she raised him as a gift from God. You know, he believed actually he was kind of a gift from God, and he did not turn out well. He was very arrogant. He had no real sympathy for other people. He was kind of an obnoxious guy all the way through. But she also, with her daughters, played favorites, because one of her daughters, Maria Christina, who I write about, who everybody called Mimi. That was her second oldest daughter surviving. Marianne was the eldest, and Marianne was kind of sickly and you know, never got married, had to go into the nunnery. But Maria Christina was talented, an artist, beautiful, you know, graceful, charming. She was a joy to her mother, and her mother leaned on her almost more, not as a daughter, but as a friend. And so Maria Christina gets everything that she wants, gets to marry a guy who was so unqualified for, you know, in terms of property and wealth and stature for the job of being her husband, Albert of Saxony. He was a younger son. He had no chance at any, his family, Frederick the Great took over Saxony, so his family lost. And then Catherine the Great took over Poland, which had also been in their family. So his family just fell lower and lower and lower. And yet Albert was allowed to marry Maria Christina. And not only that, but to make it, I love this. There's one line that Maria Theresa tells her daughter, all her daughters said, never marry a man who has nothing to do. So she gives Albert something to do. She makes him governor general of Hungary. She gives him all this. She gives the couple all this money, and they become one of the wealthiest. They're so wealthy, they can become like the premier art collecting couple of the 18th century. But her other daughters all have to go and marry whoever. And this leads us to Maria Carolina, who is my personal, I will say Maria Carolina's story is like nothing. Maria Carolina is 15 years old, and she has to go marry the King of Naples. And this guy, Ferdinand, King of Naples, this is not a guy you want for a husband. You don't want him for a sovereign either. I mean, he was just juvenile, and he didn't pay any attention to government. They once asked him, they said, her brother asked him, he said, so what have you done to improve the lives of your subjects during your reign? And Ferdinand thought about it for a minute, and he said, nothing, nothing. And he was perfectly happy with that. He would have been perfectly happy to just hunt all day. And he was a terrible philanderer. He gave her, he gave his wife venereal disease. I mean, he was just, so Maria Carolina at 15, it goes down to Naples, and marries this guy who she, you know, and it's not like Marie Antoinette did not actually have to consummate the marriage for some time. Maria Carolina at 15 had to consummate it that first night with a guy that she had just met. You know, that was very hard. And then she had eventually had to take over the kingdom in order to run it, because he would run it, and it was going to be him. A minister was just going to do it, and that never works. And she was really good. She really tried. She was just like her mother. She read every paper. She chaired her own councils. She tried to improve education. She gave them a navy. Naples had no navy. Naples is on a bet, you know, Naples is a peninsula. It should at least have something for defense, right? They never had a navy before her. So she did everything right. In fact, she ushered the kingdom into its golden age. And then, of course, comes the revolution and Napoleon, and she has to fight everything that Marie Antoinette did, plus Napoleon, in order to try to survive. So, I mean, I thought she was really terrific. Oh, and she also had all those children. She also had like 18 children too. So it was, you know, she was really a lot like her mother. Her mother said, "She's the most like me."
Still to come on the History Extra podcast.
He needs Marie Antoinette. He cannot function without Marie Antoinette by that time. She is his emotional support throughout his entire life. But there are times in the revolution where Louis shuts down completely and doesn't speak. And everybody has to go to Marie Antoinette and tell her what they want.
This episode is brought to you by Indeed. We're driven by the search for better. But when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging, so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/History Extra. Just go to Indeed.com/History Extra right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
Life is a highway. And on it, there will be many chicken sandwiches. But there's only one McCrispy. So go ahead and hit the turn signal if you know about this juicy gem of a detour.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
So we've got two formidable daughters there, Maria Christina, who is the second surviving daughter, Maria Carolina, who is the 13th child and 10th daughter. And so where does Marie Antoinette come in?
So Marie Antoinette is the youngest daughter. She's the 15th child, I think, yes. Marie Antoinette needs a new publicist, basically. She was only 14 when her mother arranges for her to marry the Dauphin, who is going to be Louis XVI. And Marie Antoinette Maria Carolina. She read every day. Maria Carolina could read. She liked to think. She involved herself. Marie Antoinette did not have an attention span like that. Personally, and I didn't put this in the book, but she might have been dyslexic. She really had trouble reading. There's something going on there because she wasn't stupid in any way. But her father wasn't a scholar. Francis, her mother's husband, that guy wasn't a scholar. They were social people, and she was beautiful and charming. So when she's 14, she's engaged to be married, and they send a French tutor to try and teach her. And you can just watch that man in his reports back go more desperate and desperate and desperate. Because what she's good at, she'll learn the curtsies. She learns how she's, you know, it was hard, all the protocol. And she learned all that at 14. She could walk into a room and tell you, she learned who everybody was and how she should greet them and where they were. But she just never could study or anything like that. And they send her off to France at 14. She's never been out of Vienna. She couldn't hardly speak French until they gave her a lessons right before she got married, which she spoke French then. But she goes to Versailles and she is married to Louis XVI. And the thing about Louis XVI, and I know that this is going to, this is hard to understand, but Louis XVI very, I think, very strongly believe had autism spectrum disorder. This is a guy who wouldn't, you can read all the records. You read all the records of observations of his behavior. He never looked anyone in the eye. He didn't speak at all when he was younger. He didn't play with the other children. In fact, he would go up on the roof and chase cats. Later, he would go on the roof and shoot cats. He had to have a very strict routine. Physically, there was something that he had all these physical mannerisms, and he just perceived, you can see that this is a man who perceived the world differently. He was very smart. He was highly intelligent, Louis XVI. But leadership involves other qualities. You have to be able to look at a leader, and he could never speak extemporaneously. He could not make a decision. He relied on the ministers. And so he was at such a disadvantage in that way. And on top of all of that, he did not understand how sex worked. Marie Antoinette's a virgin when she comes. And so the two of them, she couldn't tell him what to do. And he didn't understand what to do. And it would take until her brother came after Louis XV dies and Louis XVI takes over. And it was only after that conversation where he and Marie Antoinette worked on that afterwards that she became pregnant. So it was very clear. So this is just another sign to me that we have someone who is, that Louis XVI was someone who was dealing with autism and needed this kind of an explanation.
It's an interesting situation. And yes, it sounds like something's going on there. I wonder if you could offer a few thoughts for our listeners, just because I know that sort of judging an individual's conditions from a position of now versus looking back, there are challenges there. What can you say to listeners about that and looking back at Louis's condition?
So I understand that diagnosing something from the past where you're not there, you can't bring Louis, too bad, we can't bring Louis in. I wish we could bring Louis in and we could go through the whole an examination with a trained person. But you can actually observe behavior. For example, in the 15th century, Charles VI of France had also a condition. He had a condition. He would, every couple of months, he would lose his identity. He would think he was somebody named George, and he would run around the castle, locked up, rave. They would lock him in the castle. He would rave. He would be naked. He didn't know anyone else around him. He rolled in his own feces. He did all this stuff. And today we say, okay, Charles VI very, very likely was schizophrenic. And that is what happened. And we are able to make that condition. Now, if you don't like a label, if you're a person who doesn't like the label of autism spectrum disorder, that's fine. But I would point you to, there's a very funny movie called Analyze This, where, I don't know if you've ever seen it, where Billy Crystal plays a psychiatrist and he has to treat Robert De Niro, who is a dangerous mobster. And Robert De Niro, the dangerous mobster, if Billy Crystal says anything to him as a psychiatrist that Robert De Niro doesn't like, Robert De Niro says he's going to kill him. So Robert De Niro comes to Billy Crystal and he says, I'm having these terrible attacks. I can't breathe. I'm sweating. My heart's palpitating. I'm shaking. And Billy Crystal says, oh, you're having a panic attack. And Robert De Niro says, panic attack? I would never have a panic attack. And Billy Crystal goes, no. It's not a panic attack. It's a sweating, breathing hard, palpitation, shaking attack. So if you don't like this autism spectrum disorder, that's fine. Just whenever you think about Louis XVI, think that he is not looking someone in the eye. He is not responding to them. Someone can be in the room with him every day for 19 years and he doesn't acknowledge them. He doesn't play with other children. When he grows up, he doesn't go around with other children. He must have a routine. He had a routine even after they was in prison. They gave him a routine. He needed an emotional support with him all the time. That Marie Antoinette filled that emotional support, or a minister earlier filled that also emotional support. He made weird facial tics. He couldn't address a crowd. He could sit for hours while a crowd screamed and didn't say a word. These are things that this is the behavior. And then he did not know how to consummate a marriage. He did not know how to have a child. So these are all things that are part of that, of the equation of Louis XVI. And the really thing that struck me was before she is queen, while she is still Dauphine, Marie Antoinette goes to Paris. This is a pivotal moment when her entrance in Paris. She goes with Louis, and she and the crowds go wild for her because they're the future of the monarchy. And there's this huge crowd there, and she's writing to her mother about it. And she says, "Oh, you would not believe it. Thank you so much for making me future queen of France. This is wonderful. We had all this huge crowd, and the Dauphin behaved so well. The Dauphin behaved well, very well." And you think to yourself, the Dauphin was 19 at that point. What does she mean, he behaved very well? You know, what was he going to do? Well, apparently he might have been kind of freaked out by all of this, and because there's a lot of noise. Autism, I think, you're getting your sensations differently, and he might have done something that she felt embarrassed him. But no, he was fine. This is not how you talk about a 19-year-old guy who's going to be king.
And I'm interested to talk a little more about the ramifications then of what it meant for their marriage and evidence of then other relationships that come out.
Okay, so it's very clear that Marie Antoinette did not love Louis as a husband. Please try and think about this. This is just a sad case, okay? I don't see that there is a lot of fault here. It's not Louis's fault that Louis loved Marie Antoinette, but he could not fulfill the role of romantic love. And Marie Antoinette is a 14, when she gets there, she's 14, but when she's like 19, 20, she's like a college girl, a beautiful college girl, and she is married to this guy who she can never look at as a romantic figure. And she's in France, which is all about, l'amour. So she understands that she is going to never have romantic love. Now, I will say that when she started in the beginning, and she accepted that. That's why she never fought any of the caricatures of her as being, because she knew it was almost an irony to her that they would make her into a harlot when she is the one person in France who's having no sex. But then after she has her first daughter and her first daughter, comes this guy to court, this Swedish Count Fersen. And, she's in her 20s, and sometimes when love hits, there's just nothing to do about it. This was true love on both of their sides, both of their parts. And he did try to stay away. He went to fight the war in America, he was gone for a long time. But then when the war was over, he just couldn't stay away, and they came together until she did have this lover. And this is known. This is known that she had this lover. And I think all you have to do is, now that of course they haven't done any DNA testing on this, but I'm sure her second son, who is eventually will be the Dauphin who dies during the revolution, and her youngest daughter who dies early, those children were both fathered by Count Fersen. Count Fersen was with her very often. He stayed in the castle with her when she was attacked in Versailles. He was there in the bedroom with her, most likely, it seems. These are all things that only happen because Louis is a different kind of, Louis has this disorder where he is not, no other French king would have tolerated that behavior, but Louis tolerates behavior that other French kings don't. When Marie Antoinette when she was younger and she wanted to go out early, wanted to go out to Paris to the theater and go out to a supper dinner afterwards or whatever she was going to do. And Louis liked to spend Louis went to bed every night at 11. So he would come and spend from like 10 to 11 with her. And she had to do that every night. But one night she just really wanted to get away. So she turned the clock back. She turned the clock from 11. And Louis was all fanatical about time. He was very interested in clockworks. And so Louis thought that it was 11 o'clock and went home so she could go out an hour earlier. And he went back to his own rooms. And when he went back to his own rooms, he discovered that she'd played this trick on him. Now, I'm going to tell you, nobody plays a trick like that on Louis XIV or Louis XV or Louis XIII or Louis XII. Nobody and gets away with it. You know, you would be, not treason, but least majesty. You know, you're going to be exiled or something's going to happen to you. Nothing happens. So because he needs Marie Antoinette. He cannot function without Marie Antoinette by that time. She is his emotional support throughout his entire life. But there are times in the revolution where Louis shuts down completely and doesn't speak. And everybody has to go to Marie Antoinette and tell her what they want. And then Marie Antoinette has to go to Louis and say very softly and gently and reassuringly, this is what we're going to do and blah, blah, and she's basically ends up having to run the government because Louis has shut down.
If we can zoom back out again to look at these four women as a whole, as you do, well, they obviously have their own stories throughout your book that are told very well. But if we can look at them at a whole at this time, what was their sort of interactions like, or how easily were they able to maintain mother-daughter relationships at this time?
Well, while she was alive, Maria Christina, the elder one, who becomes, she was not only Governor General of Hungary, she becomes also Governor General of Brussels and in Belgium and the Austrian Netherlands. So she has to also fight the French Revolution. Maria Christina was nearby her mother all the time because her mother needed her. And so their relationship was very strong all through Maria Theresa's life. Maria Carolina would get letters from her mother, was sent off to Ferdinand with a long letter explaining how to live, how to rule and things like that. And Maria Christina tried very hard to keep the family together after her mother died. She would, and even while her mother was alive, she went down to Italy, checked on everybody, brought back pictures of the grandchildren, portraits, and showed them to her mother. And Maria Christina tried to be close to Marie Antoinette. But Marie Antoinette was younger by a lot. And unfortunately, while she was growing up, Maria Christina had to take over the role of disciplinarian every now and then, as an older child does sometimes with the younger ones. And so Marie Antoinette resented that, and she thought she tattled to her mother about her. And Marie Antoinette, on top of having Maria Christina looking over her shoulder, Maria Theresa sends actually a surrogate, like a spy on Marie Antoinette, which is how we know so much about her life, because this guy would just sit there and write down reports all the time, every day, a report to Maria Theresa. Maria Theresa tried to do some long distance parenting through her ambassador. And that didn't work because Maria Theresa did not understand what the French court was like. And so Marie Antoinette, who was there, did understand what was going on and listened less and less and less to her mother. And Maria Carolina and Marie Antoinette never got to see each other. They were the closest of friends when they were children. And then they were kind of wrenched apart. And they communicated, but they never saw each other again. And Maria Carolina loved Marie Antoinette and only wanted to protect her and tried so hard. Maria Christina and Maria Carolina helped to orchestrate the failed escape from Paris that Louis and Marie Antoinette tried with the help of Count Fersen, and it just didn't happen. So, but they did, they were very conscious. The women, the daughters were so conscious of being the daughters of Maria Theresa. There was a pride in there. There was a way of behaving that they thought they should, you know. Marie Antoinette, say what you like about her. She stood down the crowds. She protected her. The crowd that broke into the Tuileries, they came for hours. She had her 8-year-old son on a table in front of her, and her 13-year-old daughter behind her, and she just held off that crowd with her demeanor. And when she went to the guillotine, she didn't never broke. She climbed those steps, and she was a queen. And you got to respect that. She was no more suited to rule than Louis was. I mean, you really did not want someone like Marie Antoinette making tax policy. This is, but she was forced to. It wasn't that she didn't want to try. I think she just couldn't do it. There are people who with the best of intentions aren't suited to it, and she wasn't suited to it, and it all came down on her. And that's why she's the face. She's the face of the monarchy, of the Ancien Régime. She's this because Louis was not there. It was like Louis wasn't there. He's there, of course, but the populace never sees his face. She's the person that appears to be running things, and so she gets blamed for that. But they were all definitely the daughters of, they all understood what mom had done, and they tried to live up to that reputation.
Yes, it's quite a legacy. And if we can perhaps touch on that a little more, you've already alluded to her death. How does that come about, and what is her legacy today, particularly in Vienna?
Maria Theresa.
Oh, yes, sorry, Maria yes. Theresa.
Maria Theresa had the problem that her son, remember I told you about her son, he's pretty arrogant, he believes he can do everything himself, and he's also affected by his mother, because here his mother at 23 fought off half of Europe, and he's still in his 30s, and she doesn't let him really rule, except for she gives him like the military stuff. So he tries to take over Bavaria and gets them into a big, not into a war, but it would have been a war, but Joseph doesn't like to fight either. And, but the Maria Theresa was just devastated that he was doing so badly at it, and that he might have exposed himself to danger in a war. And it really took a lot out of her. Her husband had already died. She wore black for, she was ready to die. So, when she does, it's right after this war, and they had to raise taxes and for Joseph's war, and they kind of blamed Maria Theresa of Vienna. But very soon after Joseph ascended to the throne on his own, they realized what a gem they had in Maria Theresa. And today in Vienna, there's a huge statue of her. And when the tour groups come, she is remembered, it's all about her. And that's right. She was a pivotal figure in that period. And I do believe that she held off the Frederick the Great, who knows where he would have gone if she hadn't been there and so dedicated to stopping him. And that whole opportunistic way of dealing with foreign relations. Frederick couldn't care less about treaties, gave his word, broke it again. And he just was completely amoral. And the result was they were always fighting. They said Prussia was an army with a kingdom rather than a kingdom with an army. And she really tried to stop that so that she could focus on the domestic, so she could improve her subjects' lives, improve healthcare, improve education, all that stuff. And she was trying to free the serfs when she died. So in all those ways, she was a really excellent ruler.
Well, she's certainly a fascinating character. And I feel, though that's a good point to end on, I also feel slightly sad that we barely scratched the surface of Maria Cristina Mimi's story or Maria Carolina, actually. But before we round up, is there sort of anything else you'd like to mention to our listeners before we mention the book again?
Yes, I would like to say one thing. So Marie Antoinette, everybody said, you know, it is true. She wasn't a good queen. She did a lot of things wrong, and she gets all the blame. Maria Carolina, she did everything right. And today she is reviled, okay, in Italy. All she tried to do was fight Napoleon, and she did try very hard to rule her kingdom in a way that was that helped the people. She tried improvements. So I think women just had, they are damned if they do and damned if they don't. I mean, here you had someone who did everything right and is hated, and everything wrong and was hated. So maybe women are just in power, are just hated.
I thought you were going to end on a positive note. That's lovely.
No, they're not. But I mean, you have a much bigger, yeah. You have a much bigger, problem. You have a much bigger nut to crack if you're a woman. You have to work much harder to get praise for or to be seen as a good ruler, I think.
Yes, no, that makes a lot of sense, sadly. And as I say, I hope this is a really lovely introduction for our listeners to these four fascinating women. But for now, I will say that In the Shadow of the Empress, The Defiant Lives of Maria Theresa, Mother of Marie Antoinette and Her Daughters, is out now. And thank you so much, Nancy, for your time in talking to us about your book today.
Thank you so much. I loved it.
That was Nancy Goldstone. In the Shadow of the Empress, The Defiant Lives of Maria Theresa, Mother of Marie Antoinette and Her Daughters, is published by Weidenfeld and Nicholson and is available from tomorrow. Thanks for listening. This podcast was produced by Ben Hewitt, Jack Bateman and Brittany Colley. On Friday, we'll be exploring some of the most extraordinary hoaxes of the 18th century.